We are back in Deuteronomy chapter 29. I hope to finish chapter 29 today. And our text, reminding us again, we'll read the scripture again so that we can remember where we are. Verses 22 to 28, and then we'll move into 29 in a few moments. Future generations of your children who follow you and the foreigner who comes from a distant country will see the plagues of the land and the sicknesses the Lord has inflicted on it. All its soil will be a burning waste of sulfur and salt, unsown, producing nothing, with no plant growing on it, just like the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord demolished in his fierce anger. And all the nations will ask, why has the Lord done this to this land? Why this great outburst of anger? Then people will answer, it is because they abandoned the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. They began to worship other gods, bowing down to gods they hadn't known, gods that the Lord had not permitted them to worship. Therefore, the Lord's anger burned against this land, and he brought every curse in this book on it. The Lord uprooted them from their land in his anger, rage, and great wrath, and threw them, tossed them into another land where they are today. Well, we mentioned last time that this broader speech from 22 to 23 divides into three different speeches. First of all, there's the observation of observers, both the descendants of the present Israelites standing in front of Moses and outsiders notice what is going on, and they see all the plagues and the diseases of the land, and they ask why the Lord has afflicted it. Their observation, verse 22b, then the response, all its soil will be burning waste of sulfur, salt, unsown, producing nothing, with no plant growing on it, just like the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord demolished in his fierce anger. This business of sulfur and salt, and the moment you hear sulfur in the Bible, you think, we've seen that before. And of course, in the end, salt, you strew salt all over a place that you have conquered to be sure that nothing will ever grow there again. You sterilize it. I grew up on the farm in northern Saskatchewan, and my father was not a very good farmer, but for 4 years I went and worked for another farmer on the western border of Saskatchewan, who an interesting character. The first year I worked for him, he had 7 quarters of land, half a mile by half a mile by half a mile. The second year, 12 quarters of land. The third year, 21 quarters of land. And the fourth year, 32 quarters of land. He was absolutely the best farmer I had ever seen. But by the time he got so big, he became totally paranoid and whatever else, and he was totally upset that he didn't win Saskatchewan Farmer of the Year Award. I mean, he was so good that the other folks begged him to work their land for 1/3 share of the crop. They would make more with getting 1/3 of what he produced than what they did themselves. And so it wasn't all his land, a good portion of it was, but I mean, we had four big John Deere tractors, whatever else. My father was not a good farmer. Here I saw what farming can be like, and actually, I think I could have farmed. He tried to set me up. No, thank you. In any case, what brings that is on the fields of Saskatchewan, we have a weed that's known as toad flax. Anybody heard of toad flax? You don't want to hear of toad flax. If you get it in your field, it starts in a place, and before long, it has taken over completely, and you can't grow anything else there but toad flax. And if you, he was so paranoid, and I enjoyed the first year working for him. I mean, he treated me like a member of the family. I went fishing for the first time in my life, and my first fish was a 14-pound jack. I went with him. We had time for the local sports day. Our church put a ball field in the. By the time we were at the end, it was a different story, and I would be driving the swather, and I'd see the pickup truck coming a half a mile away, and I'd just freeze. What's he going to scream at me now for this time? Became very paranoid, and I never forget being screamed at for having gone through a toad flax patch. It was a small one, and I didn't recognize it. You can't see everything. And I didn't bother lifting the cultivator, because if you drag these roots to anywhere else in the field, after we came off a field with toad flax, before you get onto the road to go to the next field, you absolutely scraped every shovel clean, because you don't want this. The only solution for toad flax is what we would call boracic acid. And it absolutely killed everything. And it's not like Roundup. You kill what's there, and the next year you can plant something there again. It's not Roundup. It killed everything for 7 years or however long that patch would be there. This is what this is the kind of salt we're talking about. Putting borescue on it so that nothing ever grows there again. All its salt will be burning waste. And of course, this practice, we didn't talk about this last week, did we? No. This practice was widespread. Here's Tiglath-Pileser I from about 1200 BC. The entire city I razed, I destroyed, I turned into a ruin hill and strewed tipu stones over it. This is the equivalent of that, or an Aramaic curse. Just as wax is burned by fire, so may Arpad, that's the city, be burned, and her great daughter city, suburbs, may Hadad, the storm god, sow in them salt. Same word we have here. As in our text, and weeds, and may it never be mentioned again. Or a Hittite curse. As salt has no seed, let me, Shatiwaza. You know somebody who's pregnant? Here's a wonderful name. Shatiwaza. Let me, Shatiwaza, together with any other wife whom I might take, and the Hurrians, together with our lands, our wives, and our sons, like salt indeed, have no progeny. So, of course, you understand in the ancient world, conception, it is January 22nd, isn't it? This day will go down in infamy. Conception was viewed as the act whereby a man planted seed in the field represented by his wife. And that's what we're talking about here. And now you extend the metaphor even to that. Like salt indeed, may they have no progeny. Like a dissolved lump of salt, let us not return to our place. That's a curse. It's a nasty curse. Well, that's what's going on here. Those are the facts. A land of sulfur and salt, burning waste, unsown, producing nothing, no plant growing on it. And then he introduces the analogy. Yeah, just like the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, we usually think only of two cities, but there are several places where you mention a quartet of cities, including Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord demolished in his fierce anger. Where's Sodom and Gomorrah? Any idea?
Near the Dead Sea.
North end of the Dead Sea. You're radical.
No.
That's nasty. That's not the traditional, and most people don't go there. We have it here. Here is a map of the Dead Sea. Here's Sodom, Gomorrah, Zoar, and Admah and Zeboim. We're not quite sure. There's a question mark there. But this is where most people put them. And if you can't see that picture, let's go here. 1, 2, 3, Sodom, Gomorrah, and Zoar, near the Dead Sea. That's where Lot chose to live. This is the traditional interpretation. I have always struggled with that. Does that make any sense? I mean, read a text like this. Here's Lot. Lot looked up and saw the whole plain, actually the whole dish of the Jordan, that all was well watered like the garden of the Lord, the land of Egypt. And of course, it's not the whole land of Egypt, it's along the Nile, in the direction of Zoar. This was before the Lord had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. That doesn't actually fit this. You've been there? The location is wrong. Lot looked up and saw. Could he have seen this? He's standing up here north of that at Bethel. Could he have seen? I got a problem with it. He looked up and he saw. The plain of the Jordan. Here's a rare word, kikar. He looked up and saw this. It means something round, a disc, or whatever else. What's that? According to the most reputable dictionary these days, it's something round, the round, especially of the Jordan Valley. This is what they say. But of course, the Jordan Valley goes a long way. It starts up in north of the Galilee and runs all the way down to the Dead Sea. And if you change the name to Arava, it keeps going south all the way to Eilat. Well, the third problem, it looked like the Garden of Eden. That southern part of the Dead Sea hasn't looked like the Garden of Eden for millennia, if ever. So I've always struggled with this. And then the text says in verse 11 and 12 of Genesis 13, Lot moved east. Really? How would you get to the southern end of the Dead Sea from Bethel? Probably not by going east. It's way down. So I've always struggled with this. So now we got, what other possibilities are there? Here's Bethel. Sodom and Gomorrah are way down here on the floor. Whatever it is, he can see it. There's Bethel. There's a guy comes to our class occasionally here. Some of you know Mark Strong. He's occasionally, I thought he might be, in fact, I mistook somebody for him this morning. He's involved in the dig at Tel Hammam with Steve Collins, and Mark Strong is part of that excavation. You can go and see a brilliant YouTube of Steve Collins. They're excavating here at Tel Hammam in the Jordan. They are absolutely convinced that they found Sodom and Gomorrah. It fits the location. And if you've been there, this is a round, disc-shaped plain. It's the lushest area of Jordan. And, of course, it extends, the Jordan is on this side. It's in this whole, it's a garden. And, you know, it seems to fit so much better, in my view. I am not an archaeologist, nor the son of an archaeologist, and so They are arguing, Steve Collins and his crew, they are arguing, they found it. Not everybody's buying it. There are problems with this interpretation. One, kikar, oval. Well, that's just an oval shape. It could apply to lots of things. It could apply to the Valley of the Dead Sea, only instead of having an east-west orientation, this oval has a north-south orientation. So that, you know, it is not absolutely convincing. The dates, and I forgot, I mean, we forgot lots of things today. We were supposed, Karen Wright usually runs off a bunch of notes for us, and she wrote, sent us a note and said, would you do that this week? And we said, yes. We lied. We didn't, so there are no notes for visitors or whatever else. In fact, I ran off for myself. I didn't even bring that. It's a great morning. The other thing I forgot is Mark Strong has given me a little, if you're really interested, I can bring it next week. It's a little jar of charred barley seeds from that excavation. I was so pleased. I took this charred barley seed to my colleague, Daniel Master, who is an archaeologist, the best in the world. And I said, here, we've got this from Tel Hamam. He knows all about Tel Hamam. He knows all about this theory, too. And he has his questions about the theory. But in any case, I gave it to him. He said, can I test that with carbon-14? And so they sent it off. And here are the results of the carbon-14 dating. You can all read that and understand it, I'm sure. But the conclusion is that these barley seeds date to a burning of this city in about 1100 to 1000 BC. Doesn't quite fit the Sodom and Gomorrah story. That's the problem here. Oh, the other side of this, of course, is that there may be layers of burning lower down from earlier times. So we wait and see with bated breath. I have a feeling, my own hunch, doesn't fit the biblical evidence. It's not way down there somewhere. I am not quite convinced yet that this is it, but we wait, and maybe one day we'll get to go and dig with these guys if the Lord tarries and we hang on. Yes, sir.
You know, from a geological point of view, it's part of the Great Rift Valley that goes all the way down to Lake Victoria in Africa.
It is.
And it's a spreading center for the two plates.
Yes.
And so it's possible that there was a collapse,
yep,
that prevented the Jordan from running down into a lot, which would have immediately created the Dead Sea then.
That's right.
We do have lots, all sorts of geological explanations for how we got here. Those of you who have been with us, you've seen this massive valley, the Maktesh Ramon, the great big valley that was created, and this is in the southern Negev, not far from the Arava. It was created by massive waters at one point, washing out the sand from underneath, creating a massive cave, and all of a sudden the crust of the earth just collapsed. It's a sinkhole. It's maybe the biggest sinkhole in the world, a massive thing. You know, so we don't know these kinds of things are going on there. But in any case, there, being a student of Scripture forces us to wrestle with all sorts of fun things. And we'll come back to the word mystery. There are lots of mysteries with respect to the plan of God. There are lots of mysteries with respect to the Scriptures. I am convinced there was a place called Sodom that got hammered. I should say sulfured. you know, so much. But I have no idea where it was. And my confidence in the Scripture doesn't depend on all of that. It doesn't. I hope one day we find something that we... There's an inscription from the gate, Sodom. you rarely have that. We have one case up at Tel Dan. They found an inscription in Greek, you know, so it's from a later time. But in Greek, there is an inscription to the God who is at Dan. They always thought this might be Dan. Archaeologists did. And they found the name. You know, so anyhow.
We think the seeds are from 1000 BC. What was the hammering? What year was the hammering of Sodom?
Oh, the hammering would be in the days of Lot and Abraham, which would be 2000 BC. So it's 800-900 years earlier. Yeah. From the time, those of you who have been to Dan with us, there is a mud brick gate up at Dan that dates, mud brick, it dates to 2000 BC. And as Abraham was coming from Ur of the Chaldees, he may well have come through that gate. But, you know, that's the time we're working with. So far. But, of course, excavations are long, arduous processes. And biblical scholars always have to be humble and remind ourselves that my interpretation is in soft lead pencil. It won't take much to change this. Historians have to do the same thing, and archaeologists have to do the same thing, so everything we say here is with a grain of salt. And of course, there's a third problem. Genesis 14 associates Sodom with the Valley of Siddim. This is a criticism that critics of this theory give. Actually, it's not such a big problem, because if you're at Tel Hammam, you can see the Jordan. The Dead Sea. It's right there. So we're not far, but the topography of the southern part, you know, looks saltier. All right. But these places become proverbial. Jesus uses Chorazim and what's the other city? Woe to you, Chorazim. And Bethsaida. They become proverbial for getting hammered by God. Oy vey, whoa! But here, in Hosea 11, which may be the second finest love chapter, divine love chapter in the Bible, after Ezekiel 16. You thought I'd give you something else. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Adamah or treat you like Zeboim? He doesn't mention Sodom and Gomorrah. He mentioned these other two places. But everybody knows what he's talking about. And then he says, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst. And he talks about, my heart is turned over within me. It's a very transparent text on the internal struggles of God over what to do with his people. Well, we'll see more of that. That's the observation of the descendants. They say this whole place is like Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, let's come then to verse 24. When the outsiders see this, notice who's talking. All nations will ask, why has the Lord, Yahweh, they use the name. What does that tell you about ancient theology? Why has Yahweh, the Lord, done this to this land? He is attached to the land. You see, we should bring back our triangle now. The world knows that the Lord, by the name Yahweh, Israel, and this land are tied together. And you notice their focus here, initially, is not on Israel. It's on the land. Why has the Lord smoked, we will have that word later, smoked this land. He must have been furious. Why this extreme outburst of anger? Well, this is how the ancients thought. They automatically think theologically. We are automatically in the other world. Our world is it's not only post-Christian, it is post-theological. The interesting thing is that sometimes the most atheistic, humanistic people have gone totally mystical. And we're consulting fortune tellers and whatever. We're doing all kinds of things that 50 years ago we were laughing at. And now it's these sophisticated elites are going to the... Really, it's irrational, certainly. Why? This is their first response. When you see a devastated land, first response, the God of this place is angry. And you're asking, why? Well, here's a text. Ashurbanipal, from his annals, 7th century. Ira, I love Ira. Ira is the god of disaster. Struck down Uati, as well as his army, who had not kept the oaths sworn to me. Who's me? Ashurbanipal. And had fled before the onslaught of Ashur, the god, my lord. He had run away from them, famine broke out among them, and they ate the flesh of their children against their hunger. We talked about that earlier. Cannibalism. Asher, Sin, Shamash, Adad, Bel, Nebo, Ishtar of Nineveh, the queen of Kidmuru, the Ishtar of Arbela, Ninurta, Nergal, Nusku. All the gods are angry. It's not just why the god of this land. They've all ganged up on this country, inflicted quickly upon them all the curses written down in their sworn agreements. We had one of these on Friday. Do we realize what we're doing when we put our hands on the Bible in an oath? We are inviting the God of the Bible to visit us with all the curses if we ever go off track. This is serious business. And of course, we do this at weddings as well. Friends, we are gathered in the presence of these witnesses and in the presence of God. That means we are invoking them as guarantors of the fidelity of the two parties. That means that if we break it, God is right in visiting us. So, in any case, that's the assumption here. Even when the camel falls, calves or lambs were suckling many times on the mother animals. They could not fill their stomachs with milk. Whenever the inhabitants of Arabia ask each other, on account of what have these calamities befallen Arabia? Same question. And they answered themselves, because we did not keep the solemn oath sworn by Ashur, the god. Because we offended the friendliness of Ashurbanipal, the king, beloved of Enlil. That's why there's disaster. This is the natural way of thinking in the ancient world. Well, let's go then to the outsiders. That's the question. Outsiders are asking, why is the church in such a horrible state? Why is God so angry? Well, here they're not saying with his people. They're saying but with the land. But when the answer comes, you will see what they say. Then they will say. Who's they? Our first response was, well, the seminary professors. The people who know their Bibles. the authorities in the Israelite tradition. They will answer the pagans' questions. But notice the third person. Then they, it doesn't say who it is, that somebody will answer, it's because they abandoned the covenant of the Lord. Well, if it were an Israelite talking, what would he say? It's because we. But their answer is, it's because they abandoned the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers. So which covenant are we talking about? The God of the fathers? Well, we'd think that. Except we're talking about generations in the distant future. To this generation, the God of the fathers is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But to a future generation, in generations to come, and of course he tells us, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. Oh, really? Well, actually, as I've mentioned before, I actually think that the God, the covenant with Abraham and the God he made with this generation coming out of Egypt, it's all one and the same. It has the same promises and the same expectations. They abandoned the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers, that he made when he brought them out of the land. What does that tell you about the world? Well, A, they're watching. B, they've learned a few lessons. What lessons did they learn? The Lord is their God. The Lord made a covenant with them. The Lord brought them out of Egypt. Oh, this sounds like Rahab. She said, we've seen what the Lord your God did for you, bringing you out of Egypt. Now you destroyed the armies of Pharaoh, whatever. You see, God put Israel, he called Israel to a public display, chapter 26. I've set you high above the nations for praise, for honor, and for glory. Whose praise, honor, and glory? Chapter 28, verse 12. When the nations see you prospering, they will proclaim over you, I actually think it means read on you, the name of the Lord. Israel's experiences are all a reflection on their God. And the nations got it. And notice their explanation for the problem. It's because they abandoned the covenant of the Lord. They knew God had a covenant with them. This is absolutely unique. We know of no other nation in the ancient world that views itself to be in covenant relationship with its God. That is true of a king and a god, in one or two instances, never of a people. But here they've got it. These people, they are special people. God has made a covenant with them. And what happens when you break covenants? Go back to this Ashurbanipal text. When you break covenants, you get hammered. They know the human cause. They abandoned the Lord, the God of the fathers. But there's more. What did they do? They began to worship, prostrating themselves before other gods, bowing down to gods that were totally unfamiliar to them. Why would you do that? I mean, even the nations are recognizing there's something wrong with this picture. The Lord had introduced himself personally to them and done all gods they hadn't known. Gods that are the gods of other nations. Israel has no business worshiping the gods of the other nations. But that's what they're doing. Even the nations are seeing how off course the Israelites are. Gods that Lord had not permitted them to worship. They see the human causation. They abandoned the covenant. They went after other gods. And of course, you know how serious this is by texts we've looked at earlier. Shema Yisrael, Yahweh Eloheinu, Yahweh Echad. Hear, O Israel, our God is the Lord, only the Lord. That's what it means to be an Israelite. That's why Ruth is the ultimate Israelite woman. Your God, my God. That's what David Bennett, or the prologue to the Decalogue. These nations have got the theology. They studied other people's texts. I don't think they actually did, but they heard the story. They know. Preamble to the Decalogue. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that's in heaven or earth, or that's on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am an impassioned God. Remember what that word means. It's not jealous. It's always translated jealous. But it means I get fired up. Because I love you, Israel, so deeply. I've invested so much. I married you. That's what, I will be your God, you will be my people. That's marriage covenant formula. But what have you done? You've gone after other lovers. And in Proverbs, that's a legitimate passion when a husband gets angry because somebody's messing with his wife. That's what you've done. You shall not bow to them. I am impassioned God, punishing the children, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who hate me. That's the human causation. Now let's look at the divine causation. But of course, they don't leave it there. I mean, we could argue that sin brings with itself its own miserable consequences. There is something really true in that. But that's not where they're going. They're going a different. Therefore, the Lord's anger. Remember, this is all in response to the question, why is the God of this land so angry? Therefore, the Lord, they're using the name of Israel's God, Yahweh's anger burned against this land, and he brought on it. Why not just stick with the people? He brought on the people all the curses of the land. But of course, you remember that triangle. This is an intimate covenantal relationship. As one goes, so goes the other. And of course, he brought upon every curse written in this book. And I need to remind you again, it's not a good translation. They had no books in ancient libraries. Books weren't invented for 1,000 years later. This kind of book. What do we mean? This written document. That which Moses wrote, we'll come to this in chapter 31. Moses wrote down all the words of this Torah in a book. No, not in a book. In a scroll, would have been in a scroll. And he gave it to the Levitical priests and said, put this beside the Ark of the Covenant. It is canonical from the beginning. It is the authoritative word of God from the beginning. Put it beside the ark. And then when the people gather for worship every seventh year on the festival of Sukkot, Feast of Booths, you read the whole thing to them. That's what he's talking about. All the curses. This is chapter 27 and 28. The Lord, his anger burned. He visited them with every curse. And actually, in chapter 28, after going through that long list of curses and whatever other curses God may dream up, it is an old, totally open system. But here he's sticking to the text. It's interesting that when you read the prophets, Jeremiah and Ezekiel particularly, they are living in the day when Judah gets all this. Judah gets sulfurized. In their description of what happens to Israel, Judah, they're based entirely on the curses. So that this is not God flying off the handle impulsively. No, he had said, this is what I'm going to do. And he does it exactly according to the letter of the Torah. It happens just that way. The Lord uprooted them from their land in his anger, his rage, his great wrath, and threw them into another land like garbage. Flushed them where they are today. Of course, Moses is anticipating a future speaker. He foresees Israel's apostasy and their judgment. That's where they are today. Not in Moses' day, but in the speaker's day, he imagines this. And of course, this introduces us to the picture of the God of the Old Testament that we fight so much, doesn't it? But this is not God's fury, God's violence against Canaanites. That's where we usually fight. I've got news for you. For every reference to God's violence against the Canaanites, there are 10 references to God's violence against his own people. Which raises the question, how can you do that? What kind of God it is? And here's where you have to read Ezekiel 16, where he gives this brilliant parable, and he begins with 14 verses of unbelievable gospel. That's why we can't speed up too much, because Deuteronomy 32 puts this all in song. And Ezekiel's chapter 16 follows exactly the structure of Deuteronomy 32. He begins with a glorious gospel. And then he talks about Israel trampling underfoot the grace of God. It's one thing for people who have never known grace to be held accountable for their sin. It's another for people on whom that grace has been lavished to be held accountable. Well, three or four expressions for God's anger. The Lord's nose burned. That's the Hebrew idiom for anger. He burned at the nose. Now, you can tell, I was in a session one time when I was sitting behind my former provost, not at this institution, at another, and there was somebody standing or presenting a paper, and I was watching my provost listening to this paper, and you could see his neck get redder and redder and redder as he went on. He was fevered at the neck. Again, I said before, I grew up on a farm and we had a few horses. My brothers mostly were okay with horses. Horses were not okay with me. There's one thing I learned. They didn't like me and I actually didn't like them. What I learned that there are times when you're working with a horse and you will suddenly see the nostrils turn red. You don't know what triggers that. But when the horse's nostrils turn red, you know, I'm getting out of here. This can't end well. And that's what we're talking about. It's the dragon. He burns at the nose. There is this recognition that your emotions are expressed in your face. We'll come back and talk about that face when we get to verse 29. God burns at the nose. In rage, literally, in nose. In anger and in gadol. Ketzef gadol. Great fury. This is superlative degree. Whenever you have something, three words for something, you know, he is saying it's as big as it gets. And here he piles it on, and in the end, extreme fury. Why was the Lord so angry? Let's not deny the anger of God. And let's not pretend that we can create God in our own images. We want a nice God, a gentle God, one who will pat us on the shoulders when we do well, and just, and then when we don't do well, who will ignore us? Or say, it's all right, you couldn't help it. Not a problem. It is a problem. Rebellion is always a problem. And our view of God has to be big enough to have that in its picture. Because if you don't get that, you won't get grace. You know, even in our evangelism, are you saved? Saved from what? What is it people need rescue from? The fury of God. That's our destiny. That's our destiny here. And this is even people who are branded with the Lord's name become the objects of his fury. If you ever act like a Canaanite, God will treat you like a Canaanite. Well, the Lord's fury is the immediate cause of his fate. It's expressed in concrete actions. He imposed on them every curse written in this book. He uprooted the population from the land. He tossed the population away into a different land. My word for that is he flushed them. Here's what we're working with, the triangle. And when the judgment hits, a grenade is thrown into the whole business. And you know that if that destroys the whole triangle, the person at the top is most grieved. This is his people in his land. Which is why when Ezekiel comes and he's at the other, on the other side of this one, in chapter 36, he says, wherever you went, you brought shame to the name of the Lord. And there the issue has become. They're the people of God. This is the land of Yahweh. Why aren't they in the land? Everywhere they are scattered, they bring shame to the name of the Lord. Why? Because people are asking. Oh, yes, we have this on paper. We got this theology. We understand. But they're still asking, what does Israel's existence outside there say about their God? And they have two answers. One, either God isn't able to take care of his people. Marduk beat Yahweh in 586. The God of Babylon beat the God of Israel. The Lord is an impotent God. That's one theory. Second, the Lord has changed his mind about his commitments to this people. And that's equally serious. At that point, they're saying, they don't make the connection between human causation and divine kids. These people are. Of course, Moses is now preaching. He is giving a sermon. He is trying to motivate fidelity. And he's imagining this picture in the future to keep this people straight in the present. Wherever they go, they bring shame to the name of the Lord. Why is the Lord so angry? We have to keep asking that question. Why was the Lord so angry in Genesis 6 that he sent the flood? Every imagination of the thoughts of human beings was only evil continually. Do you think God had fun on the day of the flood? Do you think God enjoyed destroying, shall we say, even the Canaanites who are not his people? Do you think he enjoyed destroying his own people? Of course not. There's a theologian, Williams, in Britain, who says, yes, God acts in fury I mean, we're trying to deny it these days that he never does that. That's not God. Yes, God acts in fury, but he always does it with a heavy heart. It's not fun for him. And so that, why was God so angry with his land? Because you abandoned the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you when you came out of the land of Egypt. How